This is The Food Fix, a podcast where we talk to researchers and innovators about how to better feed the world. Welcome back to another installment of The Food Fix. I'm your host, Taylor Holterman, and today I'm with Josh Rosenstein. He's the owner and founder of Edible Eden Baltimore Foodscapes, a company that designs, installs, and maintains edible gardens and ecological landscaping for homeowners, businesses, and schools in Baltimore, Maryland. So Josh, let's start at the beginning. You had about 25 years of experience working in the plant world with agriculture, farming, and landscaping work, the last 10 years of which you were working for nonprofits with educational farms, developing their farming programs and businesses. What led you to move from that to founding Edible Eden?
You know, after the umpteenth hour of a board meeting with a bunch of totally disconnected rich people telling me to do something crazy on the farm because of their vision, I started feeling like we were just kind of churning our wheels, spinning our wheels rather, and that small business might be a more nimble and impactful way of addressing some of these issues that I'm committed to working on. But I was exposed to this concept, you know, rooted in permaculture, a small business with a triple bottom line, a small business that seeks to take care of the people working for it, to take care of the earth that it's stewarding, and then also to generate a profit. And so with that, I, got a 20-year-old pickup truck and a shovel and my first client.
Sticking with permaculture, you explained to me that it is a design system created in Australia in the 1970s and now used worldwide. The basic idea is that many human-made systems, an example might be fossil fuel-based systems, are not sustainable as far as longevity is concerned. But we can do better if we take cues from nature. So permaculture is made up of principles, ethics, and practices you can use as a lens to design sustainable systems. Do you have an example of this from Edible Eden?
A great example that's really relevant to what Edible Eden does is the concept of a guild planting. If you look at any forest in the world, you're going to see a similar pattern. You're going to see big, tall canopy trees, and you're going to see medium-sized sub-canopy trees, and you're going to see tall bushes, and you're going to see short bushes, and you're going to see herbaceous perennials, ground covers, and roots, right? So in permaculture, we say, great, that's a pattern that works. It works all over the world. We know it works because nature does it consistently. Let's follow that pattern. But let's do it in such a way that it supports maximum benefit for humans. That's a permaculture concept. And it's one that, for instance, at Edible Eden, we've translated into a product, right? We have a product called the Guild Garden, which is we rock up to your suburban front yard, kill off grass on an 8-foot circle, and plant one apple tree, 3 berry bushes, 6 pollinator or insectary plants, lay mulch around it. Boom.
Edible Eden's growing practices are all organic, but I feel like that's a term we often hear about without ever really understanding what it means. What do you mean by organic gardening?
First of all, organic can either be capital organic or lowercase organic. And if it's capital organic, then really you're talking about something that's been certified by a certifying entity. In order to be constituted capital O organic, there's a really significant paper trail. Like depending on the state and the certifying agency, you have to show that the soil that you're farming in has not had anything that's excluded from organic certification process for a number of years. You have to show that, you know, any materials that you're using fit that same profile. You know, don't include anything that's on the bad list. And that's really all. The vast majority of the growing that we're doing is either in people's yards or in container-based systems on rooftops or raised beds or what have you. It doesn't really, like, it's not really a thing that we could get certified capital O organic. So what I mean by that is that we follow all those same guidelines, like our, we wouldn't use a pesticide that wasn't part of the OMRI, body of approved organic materials, or a fertilizer. But to my knowledge, I don't think it would be possible to certify anything that we do as capital O organic just because we can't show, it's not in brown. So we can't show like a 3 or 5 year history of how that soil was used.
What you're doing is also an example of urban gardening, which at its simplest is creating gardens in towns or cities. What might one of your gardens look like?
What I found and what we mostly do is that you know, many urban settings, either there is no soil, right, because you're talking about someone's concreted pad, or the soil is corrupt because there used to be some sort of, you know, lead covered shed or factory or what have you in that spot. And so it really doesn't make sense to try and produce healthy food in that actual ground, which is why most of our, certainly our urban focused gardens are container based. So we came up with this product called a microfarm. Most row homes in Baltimore have between 14 and 16 feet across in their backyard. So a microfarm is a 4-foot by 4-foot, 3-tier raised bed. You can picture something that's 4 feet by 4 feet that fits into a corner that has 2 tiers of actual built, 2 feet on the back, 1 foot on the bottom, and then trellises going up the back, creating the corner, such that you could have, you know, say tomatoes in the deeper rooted container, say Swiss chard in the lower rooted soil, in the shorter soil, and then cucumbers growing up the back, and then hang some pots of strawberries from the top of the trellis. So you're basically getting like 3 or 4 actual layers of food being produced in this 1 4-by-4 thing. And if you put 4 of them across your 16-foot backyard, you know, you'd basically have a turnkey production system much bigger than the actual footprint of your 16 feet across corrupt concrete backyard.
I'm from a rural area, so when I think garden, I think of flat dirt and crops in rows, which is very different from what you're thinking about when you make these designs. What are some of the other things you have to keep in mind when creating these urban gardens?
Well, probably one of the biggest questions that we get, especially in Baltimore, I don't know if Baltimore is kind of known for its rat problem. We don't actually say that word out loud. We call them the RATs. You know, people are very concerned about attracting rodents into their space, and that, depending on people's sensitivity and what part of the city it is, you know, you could certainly see rats or squirrels chewing on tomatoes or nesting underneath built things. So I do think just taking into consideration what we're working with and what we're trying to defend against. You know, when I'm in the suburbs, people are primarily concerned with deer and groundhogs. We spend a lot of time figuring out how to defend gardens against deer and groundhogs. In the city, they're worried about the rats and the squirrels.
The company's mission statement includes helping people connect with their food source and supporting healthy ecosystems and biodiversity. These are a lot of important concepts that I was excited to see. But how do you go about accomplishing this?
Anyone that works with us on their garden gets some education and some inspiration just along the process. But one of our flagship products that I'm particularly excited to grow is the Garden Coach Program. And for that, we meet you in your garden once a month, and we bring all the things, and we've now developed curriculum handouts for the first year and are almost through our second year. So you could do this program for 2 years in a row and still have an additional, you know, a new lesson to learn at each monthly session. But once a month is not enough to stay on top of your garden. Like, the implication of the Garden Coach Program is that you're then going to take that stuff that you're learning from us and implement it in your garden over the other weeks of the year. And that's something that I'm really excited. I mean, one vision that I have that I'm eager to work on, if we ever catch up, is to make that more of an online offering and broaden the market for that and put it together with a curated online store through our website, such that, let's say you are not in Baltimore, such that we could rock up to your house with a van, but rather you were in Ossé, Michigan, and you wanted to have a garden coach without a bleed-in, you could still have the program through an online setting customized to your garden. And then when we say, look, we really recommend using an organic form of BT to treat these caterpillars, there'd be a link right there where you could purchase that through our website. The other one, in terms of ecological impact, you know, all the things that we do with perennials, perennial polyculture, pollinator gardens, and generally, whenever we sell fruit trees, we're able to include pollinator plants, insectiary plants, companion plants. So most of our customers at this point have some sort of perennial-based installation. It struck me early in the game that, like, it's a bit of a tagline, but really every square foot, like every square yard, every increment of soil that we get to steward means that that soil is, first of all, not going to have any toxic chemicals or fertilizers or pesticides applied to it. Second of all, it's going to get treated with undyed, you know, naturally sourced mulch and compost. And third of all, it's going to get planted in perennial crops that are going to support native wildlife and build soil tilth just by virtue of, like, you know, being who they are.
What else can you tell us about Edible Eden?
You know, I started out in this conversation talking about a business with a triple bottom line, right? A business that aspires to take care of its people and take care of the earth under its stewardship and generate a profit. And, you know, for the first few years of the business, I was like, I really love to say that. Like I said that all over the place and I felt really good and in my integrity saying that. The tension behind that, behind being able to actually do that in a way that's meaningful and relevant and sustainable, is actually still a nut that I'm trying to crack. Like that's a really hard thing to do. For instance, I really think that Edible Eden should offer health insurance. A, because it's the right thing to do. And I want to, like I just said, take care of the people under, you know, that are working for the company. B, because it would help us offer a really competitive, great job for people that we could hopefully hold on to for a while and build that sense of team and community. You know, as of right now, if we instituted health insurance this year, we would go out of business within 6 months. How do you figure that one out? Here's another example. Our mix that we were using to fill raised beds with, we had a company mixing it for us. I was really pleased with it, had all sorts of different stuff in it, and none of them was peat. We were using ground up pine fines from Virginia. We were using various different things, all of which were relatively close to home and none of which involved extractive, you know, mining or peat. Kind of sucked. Introduce some peat into a raised bed mix and it's suddenly this really fluffy, productive, much better mix, right? But do we want to be a business that's in business using peat, right? An extractive product that's not ultimately sustainable? We say, great, Josh, fine. No peat. We're going to use coco coir. Coco coir is a waste product that's shipped from the other side of the world using fossil fuels. There's a lot of warm and fuzzies about what we do. We do a great thing. And I feel like we're really giving a gift to our customers and to the world. And I'm proud of what we do and of how far I've been able to bring it in 8 years. But man, the nuances of ethics and integrity when it comes to walking the walk, when it comes to what it means to create a sustainable position and pay competitive pay and attract people that you really want to be working with and give them a job that they can feel good about and pay and take care of their family with, right? And when it comes to building a product using sustainably sourced materials that are part of the solution and not part of the problem, man. It's really complicated. So I guess I just wanted to put that out there as well, because that's something that I, you know, every day I'm trying to figure out and think about and do better at, while also trying to figure out how to, you know, connect those dots to bring in enough money to make it all work.
Josh, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. And for anyone interested in learning more, Edible Eden's website is linked in the episode description.
Well, Taylor, thanks so much for having me on. I, you know, relish the opportunity to talk about this stuff that I spend all my hours and days working on and thinking about. And yes, please do check out our website. And any thoughts, feedback, connections are relevant. So shoot me an email at josh@edibleedenfoodscapes.com and have a great day.
This is the end of another episode of The Food Fix. Thank you so much for tuning in. We release a new episode every Tuesday at 5 a.m. In our next episode, I talk to a researcher who found that optimizing your diet could add over a decade to your life expectancy. If that sounds interesting to you, you can join me right back here on Tuesday, April 5th. Until then, you can follow us and reach out on Facebook and Twitter at MSU Food Fix to join in on the conversation. This podcast is brought to you by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism, and I've been your host, Taylor Halterman. You've been listening to The Food Fix.